Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, I'm going to give a talk called Buddha's Robe, and I'm very excited to see Valerie here. Thank you for coming. The first time I saw one of these, I didn't know what it was. The first one I saw was a blue one, a kind of cloth with rectangular patterns on it. I was at a writing and meditation retreat with my first teacher, Natalie. She was wearing one of these around her neck. And since she was a writing teacher, I thought that maybe it was a pencil holder. And I thought, oh, Natalie must be keeping her pens and pencils in there. It's awfully big though, but she has a lot of pens and pencils. So I thought that for a couple years, and when I told her what I thought, she completely burst out laughing. And that's when I found out it's not a pencil holder. It's actually a small version of Buddha's robe. So if you've ever been mystified by Buddha's robe and don't really know what it means, you're definitely not alone. And I thought it would be a good thing to share with you some of the things that I've learned. There are several layers to a modern Zen robe. The bottommost layer is the juban, which is a white collar undergarment. Then we have a light kimono, which can be light in color or even white sometimes. Then we have this outer black kimono, which is a little thicker and durable, and also known as the koromo. Then on the outermost layer, we have what is called the okesa, from this shoulder to this shoulder. Now, these different pieces of the robe come from our tradition, dating all the way back to the time of Buddha. In the time of Buddha, 2,500 years ago, there wasn't an elaborate ordination ceremony, and the process for robes was a bit different. So your ordination ceremony would just be the Buddha saying, "Come, monk," and the monk would go follow the Buddha. They gathered rags from discarded pieces of cloth and would purify them. After boiling and cleaning them, they would crush up roots and tubers and dye the rags a kind of muddy off-yellow saffron color. Then they would take these pieces and sew them together into a robe. See here, there's the little pieces that are sewn together. From Suzuki Roshi, I have a list of 10 types of rags that would have often been used. Cloth chewed on by an ox, scorched by a fire, soiled by childbirth, left at a graveyard, discarded by king's officers, gnawed on by rats, soiled by menstruation, offered at a shrine, offered in petitionary prayer, or brought back from a funeral. These scraps of partially ruined and discarded cloths were people's trash, garbage that they wanted to throw away and get rid of. And rather than throwing it in the garbage, the followers of the Buddha would cut off the burned and damaged edges. They would wash, boil, and purify the cloth. Then they would dye it an earthy brownish yellow color and sew it into a robe of liberation. This was kind of unheard of before, and this is the first example I know of where a spiritual practice actually teaches recycling, that one man's garbage is another man's treasure, teaching us not to be wasteful, teaching us that through our own efforts, we can transform filth and garbage into something beautiful, powerful, and liberating. So the first Buddhist robe started with what is called now the okesa, this one-shoulder saffron robe. That's what the Buddha wore, Obviously, it was much hotter in India than it is here and in Japan. In places like Thailand, they still wear the one shoulder robes in saffron color. It's very hot there as well. Now, when the transmission of the Dharma went from India to China, that's when the underlayer kimono came. And as the transmission reached Japan, then they wore Japanese style kimonos. And this thicker kimono, also known as the koromo, was added. But at that point, they were not wearing the okesa. So at some point, it was mentioned that they should bring back the okesa, the original Indian garment, and that was added on top. So now the full set of robes that we wear represent our entire heritage, dating all the way back to the time of Buddha. Traditionally, all monks would sew their own robes. Now, there's something very powerful here because, especially in our modern times, we typically buy our clothes. We don't make our clothes. I think other than mending some socks, this was the first article of my own clothing I actually made. I'm deeply impressed that historically people made their own clothing, even my grandmother. She would sew clothing for her entire family, my mom, her sister, my grandfather. It's completely different to make something with your own two hands than to buy something at a store. By the practice of sewing Buddha's robe, we get to experience a kind of empowerment, breaking off from the dependency of mass-produced objects and mass-produced clothing. Being commuter monks or city monks or practitioners that have daily jobs, it might not be practical for us to sew full-length robes, because we have to work at a job and pay the rent, and we often need office clothing. But what we've done often at Kenendo is we sew this miniature version of the okesa by hand, which is called a rakusu. It's a good practice to experience sewing something for ourselves, doing something with our own effort. One thing that distinguishes Buddhism from many religions is the focus on our own effort. We don't try to change and convert people, and we also don't sit back and hope for the best. In Buddhism, there's no devil to blame for our misdeeds, and there's no Santa Claus in the sky to grant us our wishes. We learn personal responsibility. We alone are responsible for our actions. Our effort is what makes things happen, and our commitment is what saves us. The rectangular patterns on the okesa represent a rice field. Now, there's a lot of symbolism with the rice field. I'm just a beginner at understanding the okesa, but I will share with you what I know. Traditionally, in the rice field, there would be a flow of water that would stream through, easily watering the rice field. So it was kind of symbolic for wisdom and nourishment flowing freely. Even the four corners have a symbolic meaning, representing the guardians of the four directions. But they also have a practical purpose. The four squares on the rakusu and the okesa, as well as on the zagu, which is the bowing cloth, are squares that reinforce the strength and durability of the cloth. So a lot of things in the Buddhist robe, as well as in Zen in general, are very practical, while they might also be symbolic. Now let's talk about the colors of the robe. In the tradition of Suzuki Roshi in our lineage, the color coding is that priests in training will wear black robes and rakusus like this, and lay practitioners will wear blue rakusus. Again, these are all supposed to be off colors. They're not exactly pure blue. Then the teachers who have what we call Dharma transmission wear this earthy saffron, off yellow or brownish color, which is what the Buddha wore. So when Les used to give Dharma talks at the Zendo, you would often see him wearing this saffron or brown colored robe. But most of us don't wear that color because we're still very young in our practice. As you see, Valerie also on this call has a brown robe. Green is a rarer color, but it can mean a lay ordination teacher. And this is just our tradition. There may be other lineages that have very slightly different color codings that mean different things. So going back to the original color, wearing an impure mustard brown was a very non-conformist thing to do, even in Buddha's time. The colors that were valued were so-called pure colors, bright reds, blues, shiny whites. If a shirt had to be yellow, they would have valued a bright shade of daisy yellow. Buddha was, in essence, sticking it to the materialist institutions of his time by insisting on wearing the color of mud. 2,500 years ago, and I'm sorry to say things have not changed much since then, there were different castes where certain groups of people were considered better than others. Some were wealthier and more privileged, and the other poorer classes were disadvantaged. These inequalities persisted from generation to generation. As you know, in the United States, we have a history of slavery, and that's not that much different from the caste system that existed in India. But Buddha did not subscribe to the caste system, just as he would have not been okay with slavery. Buddha did not treat people from different castes better or worse than others. He treated everyone the same. Now, there was a little caveat with women who were practicing. Buddha was more or less kind to them, but the woman really had to insist on being part of the practice, banging on the monastery doors to get attention in order to gain their place in the practice. One of the earliest insistent women was Mahaprajapati. The woman who raised the Buddha, she was basically his mother. They did have more rules to follow in the beginning, but eventually, due to their persistence and effort, women became an integral part of the practice. And eventually, they also became teachers of the practice, although it took some time. You do not have to be rich or of noble birth or well-educated to wear Buddha's robe. Your race, caste, family of origin, and gender do not matter. Your sexual orientation does not matter. It does matter that you make an effort to be faithful and honest in your relations. You do not even have to be an ordained monk to wear Buddha's robe. Sitting robes, which are slightly different in style, can be worn by anyone who's a serious practitioner, if you want to feel a more formal connection to the practice. And even if you're just wearing street clothes, meaning you're wearing a t-shirt and sweatpants, you can still practice the Dharma, and it's really not any different. It's about your mind, about your awareness and your practice of the teaching. The robe can help us put on that mindset, to remember that awareness. But if someone stole my robes or took away my robes, I would still have my robes. You know, I am the robe. I am the rice field. It's a symbol of the earth and everything it contains. So when we take all of these little pieces, these little scraps of fabric, and sew them all together, that's many coming together into one, showing that ultimately we all are one. When we sew the robes, we go very slowly, with great concentration, making very tiny stitches in a straight line, evenly spaced. It took me about 5.5 years to sew my rakusu. It doesn't have to take that long, and sometimes it can even take longer. But I had some challenges in my life during those years as well, so I couldn't dedicate a lot of time to sewing. But it was steady and slow. And through that time, I learned focus, concentration, persistence, mindfulness, and a lot of patience. And I still have a lot more to learn. If your mind is wandering off daydreaming, your stitches will show it. If you're angry, rushed, or frustrated, your stitches will show it. And if you have a calm, steady mind, then the stitches will come out more even. You won't have to undo so much of your work. The robe is a mirror of your mind. So this is the teaching It's less about the physical object and more about the practice and the character development. Zen students who sew are under the guidance of a teacher, and the teacher writes a new name for you on the back of the rakusu. The new name has to do with your character. The very last stitch of the rakusu, so first I'll show you the back, and the very last stitch is what we call the pine needle stitch, and it's in green thread. I don't know how it exactly came to be this symbol, but the pine tree is an evergreen. Even in times where it's not very rainy, it stays green. It has a long life. So it's a symbol of protection and long life. It's probably been a year since I finished sewing this rakusu, and it was only a few weeks ago that I was in the backyard with my sister. The trees had to be trimmed to not interfere with the house, and it was suggested that we should just cut down this pine tree that was growing in crooked. Many years ago, I would not have even thought twice about cutting down a pine tree. It's a hassle. You got to clean up all the needles. It might get too big. It might get too tall. But when the inspector said we should just cut down the pine tree, it's growing crooked anyway, immediately my mind flashed back to that pine needle stitch on the back of my rakusu. So I hesitated and I said, well, do we really have to cut it down? Could we trim it so it doesn't get unmanageable? Is it really harming anything? Is there another way? I can't say for sure that we'll be able to keep that pine tree forever, but I can see the change in myself from someone who previously would have cut down a tree without a second thought, just because it was convenient not to clean the needles, just because an inspector said we should do it, just because we could replace it with a nicer looking tree. And instead I'm thinking, is that really necessary? Can we give it a chance? So that brings me to the next point about the robe, which is the precepts. Robes and ordination really is about the precepts. There are 10 precepts, as well as other vows that are taken at ordination. I should say 10 prohibitory precepts. They're somewhat similar to the 10 commandments, but also a little bit different. They cover things like not intentionally killing, not stealing, not speaking ill of others, not being greedy. And none of us can actually execute them with perfection. All life lives off of other life. But what we can do is do our best not to cause harm in the way we live. It's a process. I still have a long way to go, and I know that I'll never be close to perfect at it. But wearing the robe is our commitment, and in every moment, just to do our best. The robe is a teacher and a friend. I remember right before my ordination, when I got my robes, and I had a conversation with Brenda, and I remember she said, "The robes will teach you how to be a priest." I didn't really know exactly what she meant, but it was actually very literal. So if you see these long sleeves, they touch almost to the floor. They're completely impractical from a common viewpoint of getting things done and being efficient with sleeves like this. However, they're very effective at making you aware of your own body and what you are doing with your body. For example, if I suddenly turn around very fast, I could just clear off a table, smashing vases and everything falling on the floor. It's not just to look pretty. It teaches you, what am I doing with my right arm? What am I doing with my left arm? And all of the things that we often do very unconsciously, we become conscious of. So the robe is a teacher just in the way it's structured. I've been talking a lot about Buddha's robe as a symbol, and it symbolizes many things, but Suzuki Roshi tells us that the Okesa is not just a symbol, but the Dharma itself. It's the practice of the sewing that's similar to the practice of meditation. It's the practice of folding the okesa and folding the bowing cloth with care, the practice of caring for the robes, of not spilling things on them, of not putting them where they could be trampled on. That teaches us how to take care of our whole life. So in that sense, the robes themselves are the practice, not just a symbol. In the morning we chant, "Great robe of liberation, field far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teachings, saving all beings." The robe is a symbol of liberation, liberation of your mind, freedom from conditioning, freedom from competition, freedom from our limited ways of thinking. It's called a great field of benefaction, which to me engenders nourishment and support. I'm going to read you a quote from Dogen Zenji. Dogen brought the teachings from China to Japan, and he's one of the key teachers in our tradition. "Listen carefully, Janaprabha. The great happiness field robe has 10 victorious qualities. While worldly clothes increase defilement, the Dharma robe of the Tathagata does not. The Dharma robe provides modesty, completes repentance, and creates the rice field of happiness. It protects you from cold, heat, and poisonous creatures. It strengthens your way-seeking mind for attaining ultimate understanding. Manifesting in the form of a mendicant home leaver, it frees people from greed and desire, cuts off 5 wrong views, and helps you to correct practice, to hold correct practice. By revering and bowing to the sacred banner Kshaya, you will have the happiness of King Brahma. When a Buddha child wears the Kshaya, a vision of a stupa arises, creating happiness, eliminating unwholesomeness, and joining humans and devas. The noble form of the Kshaya arouses respect in a truth seeker who is free from worldly dust. All Buddhas praise it as an excellent field, most beneficial to sentient beings. The inconceivable, miraculous power of the Kshaya nurtures practice for enlightenment. The sprout of practice grows in the spring field. The splendid fruit of enlightenment is like a harvest in autumn. The Kshaya is true armor, impenetrable as diamond. The deadly arrows of delusion cannot pierce it. I have now recited the 10 excellent merits of Kshaya. Dogen Zenji, Power of the Robe. You will notice that Dogen mentions words like sprout, spring field, harvest, and the splendid fruit of enlightenment. The rice paddy, which is the pattern sewn into the Buddha's robe, is agricultural. It has to do with farming. While reciting these 10 excellent benefits of the robe, we have to remember that it doesn't come without effort. Just as you need to plant rice, water it, harvest it, we need to cultivate our practice in order to reap its benefits. The sewing and the wearing of the physical robe can be an aid for us in developing our practice. But I did not become a more holy person just by putting on a robe. I think that the robes have had a lot to teach me, as a reminder to pay attention. But the most important thing I want to leave you with is that the robe is always there. The robe encompasses all creation, and it's not limited to a physical object, and it's not limited to times when you're wearing a physical object. So no one can take your robe away from you. Even if you don't have a robe, your skin is your robe. All of you sat zazen tonight, and whatever you sat zazen in becomes your robe. Your robe is your practice. So with that, I'm going to close with a quote from Kodo Sawaki Roshi. Wherever it goes, the snail is at home when it dies. There is no world outside the Okesa. Thank you, everyone. And we're now open for any questions or comments. Columbine.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Columbine.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering, you mentioned undoing the stitches. Mm-hmm. Are you allowed to undo it, or should you keep it as a reminder of what happened?
It's a good question. Yes, often we undo stitches. If it goes crooked, if they're inconsistent, we will often undo it and start again because it needs to come out even. But there's no, things will never be perfect. I remember one time, and I think part of the joy of sewing is doing it in a group. I was sewing with Paul Slakey for the longest time. And one time he was so irritated that one of his stitches was a little off, but it was way back and he didn't want to undo it. And I remember him saying like how much he hated that stitch and how it was too long. And I looked at it, I said, that's my favorite stitch. So you don't always undo mistakes because you're never going to get it perfect. But at some point we have to say, is it good enough to move on? Right. Mm-hmm. Brenda.
I just want to say that was absolutely beautiful. Very touched. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I didn't come up with it, but, definitely embraced it.
Diane,
yeah, Diane. Oh, go ahead, Diane.
Thank you, Bonnie. That was really a beautiful talk. You stitched together and wove a really sort of beautiful poetic talk. I really enjoyed it. I was taken with what you said about perfection. I don't think I could ever get past the first stitch. I'm such a perfectionist. But I love what you said about your favorite stitch was Paul's hated stitch. I'm thinking about what I heard about the Navajo Indians when they weave a blanket. They usually have some imperfection woven in just to remind them that if things aren't perfect. And I think it's similar to what you said about the stitches. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. And I believe there's an artistic method or something in Japanese art as well, where they will often intentionally introduce a flaw to out of respect for the imperfectness of life.
Right, right.
Thank you.
Yeah, just a remark. The thing you're talking about, I believe, Bonnie, is wabi-sabi.
Yes, that's it. See, no wonder I cannot remember the name. Yeah, thank you. I'll just remember like wasabi, but with an extra wa in it. Teresa.
I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to tell you how beautiful your rakusu is.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just for reference, my rakusu is beautiful, but it's actually quite fragile. When I started sewing it, I was the first person at Kanendo to start sewing in a long time. And so the first fabric we used is actually super fragile and not ideal for a rakusu. It's not very durable. And I sewed it anyway and had to be very, very careful with it, extra careful. But in a way, it kind of suited me because this is not rakusu material. And I felt like I wasn't priest material, but it could become a rakusu with some love and care, right? Valerie.
Good evening, Bonnie.
Hi, Valerie. Great to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you so much. It was just, I'm just beaming over here watching you and your robe give this talk about the robe. It's lovely.
This is the most beautiful Okesa I've ever, ever seen. You know who sewed the Okesa? Valerie did. She did.
It was a joy in every stitch. It was. My question is that often when I talk about the robe, the biggest objection I get is how separating it is, that it separates, it gives a visual separation, which implies hierarchy because of who we are. I've even had people call it gang colors. So what is your teaching on the separation or not of the robe? How does that feel to you?
Thank you. That's a very important question. It is separating, but it depends a lot on the context. So when we choose to wear a robe, we are setting aside this time and this intention and being very formal about it. We are actually, you know, same as when we enter the Zendo, this is a sacred space. So when I put on the robe, this is a sacred space. You know, one of the things, even to put on the robe, I kneel wherever I am. And that's how we're taught, you kneel to put on the robe. So the ritual of doing that puts us in a different mindset than if I just, you know, plop on the cushion after eating a bunch of potato chips or whatever, you know? I mean, it is a transition. It is a separation. I think separations, discriminations, differences have different implications depending on the context. And I think what this shows us is that, you know, the Okesa being a, you know, kind of representation of the entire world, is that we have problems in our world with hierarchy, with gangs and gang colors, with abuse, with exclusion, and that these are real problems. And often people will come to Zen practice who have already experienced that. They've experienced some kind of exclusion in their life. They've experienced divisions. They've experienced hostility between different groups, between different races, between people who wear red or people who wear blue. And that is part of the karma that we're working to untangle. So it will naturally come up in the practice to try to be healed. I think it's very important that if we want to stay true to the teachings of the Buddha, that we make it very clear that everyone can wear robes if they choose to, and that it's not an exclusive thing, that only some people can. It's really a choice that everyone has. And I also think it's important that we let people know that it's perfectly okay to practice in regular clothing. You know, before I had this is a kind of embarrassing. I had one black sweatshirt that I would wear because it was dark, and I got it free from the Milpitas Boxing Center, and it said no pain, no gain, and it had boxing gloves, and people would, like, they literally told me that they would look at me in my boxing sweatshirt and be like, oh, she's here, I guess it's all right for me to be here. Like, so it's totally okay. I think the most important thing we can do is just have conversations about it so that people understand what is the intention, what does it mean? Because if we're staying true to the teachings of the Buddha, it is a very anti-hierarchy thing. And that's the true teaching.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mike?
Okay, well, thank you so much for the talk. It was very enlightening. You mentioned sewing, that if you are angry, your mind is distracted or disturbed, it's going to show up in your stitches. It's going to show up and your stitches are going to be off in some way. My question is, when you realize that your stitches are off and your mind is disturbed, what do you do about that? Because sometimes you can't just correct the stitches. You can't just, if you're really angry at something, you can't just stop, you know. You can't always just correct your mind if it's just really intently sort of deluded like that, or if the stitches are really off. So like you mentioned, your friend made an improper stitch and he was sort of pissed off about this, for lack of a better word. So what do you do when your stitches are off? What do you do when your mind is disturbed and you can't really center it?
Thank you. It's the same as meditation. Slow down, take a deep breath, and it might take some time, but gradually the mind slows down a little bit. Your breathing will gradually fall into rhythm. And sometimes just acknowledging what you're feeling. I'm frustrated that I didn't do this or that, or just acknowledging that you're frustrated or whatever you're feeling. But I'd say it's really the same as meditation in my mind.
Okay.
So what do you do when you're pissed off meditation?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What do you do when you're upset in meditation?
It depends on what I'm upset about. Mm-hmm. I try to sort of look at it and then acknowledge the feeling and then bring my attention back to the breath.
Yep, perfect. That's the practice. Yeah.
Sometimes if the feeling is so overwhelming, I don't go into meditation. I do something else.
Yeah. Sometimes walking meditation might be good for that, or running meditation, maybe get it out.
Yeah. I usually paint. But thank you.
Yeah. Hey.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. It's really beautiful sharing. You know, often we say, you know, we're doing zazen, and actually it's not we're doing zazen, it's zazen doing us, right? So I'm just curious that any moment during your song, it sounds like you've sung for a long time. So any moment you feel like suing is do you, you know, is that a very common, I don't know how to describe it. It's just really, of course you want to forget yourself, right? I'm just amazed to hear that you've been sewing this for 5 years. And then I remember I visit with less permission. I visit you guys sewing at one time last year. That was a really profound moment. 5 years, yeah. Tell us maybe more about that 5 years. How does sewing do you? Thank you.
Yes, I'd say that there are times where you get really in the rhythm of things. And when you're really in the rhythm of things and there's just sewing, and that's when you're not thinking about, I need to go to the grocery store to get almond milk, and I have this work thing due tomorrow, and you're not even thinking about your identity or your race or your, you know, name. You're just sewing, and it's actually very peaceful, similar to in meditation where you're just free from distractions. So there are definitely nice times like that, and you kind of come out of that feeling very settled when that happens. In terms of why 5 years and why what happened during that time, I think, of course there were the usual work distractions and things, but I think I also went through a period of doubting myself. and doubting whether Zen, I don't know. I always knew Zen would be part of my life. I always knew that I would be practicing meditation. But I think we all eventually hit some roadblocks where we think that, oh, if I practice or if I do this path, then this disappointment shouldn't happen, right? Or, you know, like, I mean, not like I thought all the traffic lights were going to be green or anything, but, you know, you just think that certain difficult things shouldn't happen if I'm practicing right. Something like that. And so I think I went through a period subconsciously of trying to process that and trying to process certain disappointments that were happening in my life. And also grappling with self-esteem issues, to be honest. I'm very open about this, that one of the things I struggled with is that I'm not vegetarian and I wanted to be more vegetarian. And I had grown up as someone who eats meat, and you don't have to be strictly vegetarian, but I felt like I should, like there were enough options, I needed to make more effort. And so there were a lot of things I felt like I wanted to improve in myself. While I might not be perfect, I wanted to get at least better at least reduce this, at least reduce my bad habits. And as well as I was processing some grief, which, nothing to do with my actions, but more to do with my expectations, right? So I think during that time, I was processing a lot of things. And eventually, I just came to a point where I felt ready and things just naturally kind of completed themselves right before quarantine. Well, not quite, but I was ordained right before quarantine. But yeah, so it was definitely a process of introspection. And because I take it very seriously, I mean, a vow is a very serious thing to make. And, you know, I just wanted to feel like I could do it, if that made any sense, or I could do my best, knowing that I could do good enough, that it was going to be okay. And I could do good enough, something like that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.